Thanks for tuning in to the HR Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Lucinda Carney. The HR Uprising is focused on helping forward-thinking people professionals deliver real lasting value in their organisations. I'm a chartered psychologist, speaker and trainer, and recently authored the best-selling business book, How to Be a Change Superhero. My day job is founder and CEO of software and training business Actus. This gives me the opportunity to work with other businesses like yours. We are focused on building a better workplace for people wherever they are located, with the help of our performance, learning and talent management software and our training and consultancy services. Every week on the podcast, I will be covering different topics and challenges, joined by relevant experts and real-life people professionals. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really hope you enjoy and get value from this week's episode. Hello and welcome to this week's HR Uprising podcast. This week, we're focusing in on the topic of diversity and inclusion, and I'm absolutely delighted to have William Rolack, who's going to come and take me on a little bit of a practical tour, I think, given your experience, William. Is that the case?
That is the case.
Do you want to do a little bit of introduction about where you're coming from, your role, and really what qualifies you to talk to our HR Uprising listeners about this topic?
Sure, Lucinda. Thanks for having me today. This is awesome. And I'm great to, have this conversation. It's a very timely conversation with all we're going through with the great resignation and the pandemic and other things that have been going on around the world. However, hello, everyone. I'm William Rolack. I'm the Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion for Workforce Logic. I come today with 12 years of background in HR leadership and 16 plus years in diversity and inclusion leadership.
Definitely
as well.
Don't look old enough to have that much experience, I've got to tell you.
Thank you. That makes my day, but it is absolutely, a pleasure to join you. And that experience really encompasses how do we move the needle, getting metrics, really getting engagement at high levels, creating high performing teams. And so we'll get a chance to talk through some of that today. And really talk about how we as well and the strategies that I've had the opportunity to build over the years also brings such a richness to Workforce Logic for both our internal strategy and our external support with our clients as well.
Yeah, so you are, I think, almost uniquely qualified to talk to us about this because you've got the HR background, you've got this diversity and inclusion expertise, you are owning the internal strategy, but you also work through your partners and have got a sort of a unique insight into lots of data in terms of diversity worldwide. Do you want to explain for our listeners what Workforce Logic does and how that is relevant? Because it probably gives context.
Absolutely. And for those of who've ever spent any time in staffing, there are some key things that I'll bring points upon. But Workforce Logic is, internally as an industry in staffing. We are a technology enabler for the staffing industry globally. And we've actually have two great awards in the past 2 years for the Baker's Dozen, which is really highlighting the technology that we utilize for the suppliers. We're basically helping clients, identify talent, identify the best talent, high performing talent around the world, and most of all, the diverseness of that talent around the world. We're supporting very, very large staffing organizations in that talent who tap into that to fill roles and fill jobs. Tremendous amount. We have about 8,000 suppliers around the world that actually tap into that technology to help us fill those roles for our clients. We also have a great deal of AI information through Engage, another arm of Workforce Logic, which actually gives us the ability and to have insight into where the talent is, which also helps us with speed of service. And so there's many different pieces around that algorithm that's constantly running that help us actually identify the talent, where that talent is, their ability to engage, their likelihood to engage in opportunities. As well as other areas around compensation, their backgrounds, where they come from, even some expressions around gender and D&I from a race and gender standpoint.
So before I go into that, because and I know we're going to talk about diversity and inclusion, but I'd love to ask a follow-up question about talent in a moment. But the sort of
businesses that some of our UK listeners would have heard of? We mentioned things like Manpower and Adecco. Those would be, so you'd be providing data and even people to them, or how, those would be the sort of people in the UK?
Absolutely. Great point. So those companies that you mentioned, like Adecco or Manpower, Aerotech, other organizations that are out there, are actually tapping into that technology to fill roles. So clients are putting the jobs in our technology, and they are the suppliers who are coming in to fill those roles. And so this gives them a great opportunity to increase their revenue base by partnering with organizations like us in our technology. But we just, that speed to service is great because we have so many suppliers around the world. And as we know, with so many resignations and other things that are happening, the difficulty to fill roles right now, this is, you know, our technology is an enabler for the staffing industry.
So we won't go on to the great resignation necessarily unless we've got time on this, because we really want to see diversity. But my one little detour. So my question here, you use the term talent a lot, and that is obviously bandied around hugely in the HR world. Do you see, or I suppose, how do you see diversity and talent knitting together more now, or do you? Because I mean, we mentioned earlier, you might say, you know, how do you find a 5G, was it, you know, an engineer? It's difficult to come up with people with Python coding skills or something. Well, that's a very specific skill related piece. Is diversity playing into the talent pool more so? Are people more interested in it, or is there anything you could share about how they fit together now?
Sure. I think the key point around talent and diversity, where they intersect, is really around, are you or are we as a client, and this could be for Workforce Logic as well, and it is Workforce Logic, but how are we answering that age-old question? How do we know as talent executives that we're doing a good job? You know, how we're expressing the data, how we're telling our C-suite and board of directors that we are acquiring the best talent. Where diversity comes in and puts a lens on that is to ensure that where there's underrepresentation, and we use that term a lot, right? Well, you know, our workforce, you know, doesn't have a marker for women. You know, are we looking like the places we live, work, and play? And secondarily, to having geographical equity, or at least geographical representation, are we best in industry? Like, those are two solid markers that we are working with both internally and our clients to really set a stage for the conversation around talent and diversity, or where diversity intersects talent.
So how would you tell that then? So if you're saying we've managed to recruit X number of people, how can, but let's just stick with male and female for simplicity's sake, let's say, sure. And you know that, you know, if you're not recruiting 50-50, because there is, then is it more of a benchmark? And you go, is that because there isn't 50-50s worth of people with those skills out there? Or is it just more of a red flag? How do you actually use that data to challenge the C-suite or to say there's an issue here?
That's an awesome point. You know, how do you challenge the understanding and the data? Because there are a lot of organizations that are utilizing a multitude of reasons of why they're setting goals, right? And there are a multitude of organizations that are almost afraid to set a goal. It's like, oh my God, it's a goal, it's a quota, what is it, right? So, yeah. So we're one of the advisory capacities at Workforce Logic, based on Engage, based on our richness of data and understanding the industry, understanding what's in the marketplace, what's the availability of individuals who are in a certain job sector, and being able to take a business unit in a specific city, anywhere around, you know, around the global points that we service. But, and I'll say example, particularly here in the US, if we're looking at Chicago and there's a business sector there that's hiring in Chicago, or if they're doing, you know, everybody's either internal or remote, we have the ability to locate that talent, but then not also locating that talent, but then setting markers. And our markers are awesome because those markers are sound markers. A lot of organizations are setting arbitrary goals, like we want to increase diversity by 30%.
Or and you don't know if that's achievable or not.
Is that right? Okay. Have we already earned that marker, right? And that's the one thing. There's so many wins out there that companies are not expressing because they don't have the data. So we're helping them understand what both their geographical equity look like, but also what does the industry look like? And because we have such a richness of information on the industry, we can actually compare their gender markers or people of color markers to the industry. And there's many wins that we uncover, that you're already over-indexed in a particular race, or you are under-indexing gender in industry. And so we immediately are able to tell where the gaps are between industry as well as geographical equity.
Great. So because you've got such a large data pool, you can give a relevant benchmark. That's what benchmark index. Is that what you mean? The same sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah? Right. Exactly.
Whether or not you are above or below it, and whether or not 30% is achievable, yeah, or realistic, or actually you might be above with only 30%.
That's so, right. Okay. We find a lot of wins. We uncover a lot of wins for our clients, which gives the talent team, gives the HR talent team the ability to express where they are on their journey. And that's truly the understanding. These markers are a journey to be best in class, best in industry, to be the best at representing your community and your environment, or the population of a particular country, or the representation of that particular area, but then also being best in industry. And we give them the ability to actually tout that they are, because yeah, they're sound markers.
We've got some real data. It's not just plucking a figure out of the air that we want to increase our diversity, whichever marker, by 5%. Okay, right. Thank you. That helps. So if we can get into then, we want to make this practical. And one of the great things is, sure, you are responsible for the talent, the diversity, the D&I strategy within your organization, and you advise on it. So, and it was quite nice the way we started there is I can see one of the things whenever I talk about strategies with people is you need to have some data and sort of some business case, yes, of business tech. So we've actually said, ideally, you find some data, which we've just talked about, close to benchmark, or get that benchmark data. But then in your organization, where you've then come up with the D&I strategy, do you want to talk to us a little bit about how you've done that and any tips on doing that?
Sure. A couple of tips on just setting the strategy is looking, you know, it's interesting because it all starts with, you know, the conversations, you know, the D&I, what I like to call our D&I strategic dialogue, you know, and that's with the CEO, the C-suite, you know, senior vice presidents and vice presidents of the organization when you're building out the strategy. To understand two things, you know, two major things. What are the business goals? What are we trying to achieve? And what is that individual trying to achieve themselves? Whether it's our general counsel, CHRO, CMO, CIO, CEO, all of the C-suite, they are individually attempting to achieve a particular goal. Well, from a D&I standpoint, there is usually many D&I practitioners use kind of four strategic pillars to put a lens over the business strategy and the business opportunity. One of the things that we want to make sure that we do in this process is begin to assess that strategy through a D&I lens. And so I'll give five key areas in which I think are just very important to really set the lens on the strategy. And those five pieces are simply put, I mean, there's, you know, one, there's the work place and culture, right? And so are our teams high performing? There's the workforce. Are we acquiring the best talent? And are we acquiring the available talent? I like to say when we're talking and speaking for the US, so I always like to say, are we acquiring America's available talent? And that represents everyone. And diversity to workforce logic, we define diversity as everyone. The other categories is, of course, social responsibility. You know, where should we be showing up for giving, charity, our green, our social sustainability initiatives for the world, and marketplace, right? How do we become best in industry and best in class? How do we take all of the great work that we're doing across the other key areas and branch that into back into the marketplace for being best in brand, best in class? The fifth piece, I think, is one that we miss. The fifth piece is inclusive leadership. So how do we show up as leaders in the business world? How do we show up as leaders across the organization? One of our great mantras at Workforce Logic is practicing the platinum rule. You know, we have others, but the platinum rule is probably the most meaningful because it helps our employees understand it's not just about treating people the way we want to be treated. It's about treating people the way they want to be treated.
And I think that's... Did you say that was practicing platinum?
We are practicing the platinum rule. The world knows the golden rule, right? So the golden rule is treat others the way you want to be treated. Well, we found out that my personal pronouns may not be someone else's. So in that regard, I can't, you know, reference they as he or she, you know, in that regard. So the platinum rule takes us into where we are now as a world, as a country, and the way that we see people in general.
It's raising your game, is it, in terms of going to the platinum rule, sort of going above the golden rule?
Yes, absolutely. This is That is, I would say, the best practice where we are now in our D&I journey as a world, as a people, and respecting others for who they are and seeing them for what they are is the beauty of the Platinum Rule.
And it really, are you saying now, maybe is that what links into leadership? You're saying it's really about understanding the other person's point of view, whatever that is. It's not paying lip service and to pronouns. It's actually really understanding where they're coming from.
That's right. And that's a great point of clarification, Lucinda, because you really have to begin to understand others. And I'll just quickly say this is a point of our diversity evolution, right? And so in our HR, as HR practitioners, this is our evolution. So we've gone from personnel management, right, to managing personnel. I mean, you know, we've been coined phrases like the paper pushers or managing the administration to human capital strategies, right? We come into human capital strategies. How do I take the skill sets and apply that skill sets with the right strategies in the right place and in the right department, in the right channel of business in order to be successful? Well, where we are today in this next evolution is all of that. But it's also, how do I then mesh that person's identity and their culture and celebrate that and understand that in order to melt that into the key strategies, the right position, whether they're remote, whether they're on-site, off-site, what's going to be best for the expecting mother, or what's going to be best for their return to work when someone goes on out on disability. Those things now, the person and all of the dimensions of diversity that they bring to work is now a better understanding of the attachment to the skill sets, to the strategy, to the human capital strategies. I just like to call that, this is the evolution to total inclusion.
Yeah, I mean, we said that when off camera, didn't we? It's really about all these different letters that we could add in, but really inclusivity actually does wrap it all up in many ways if we're genuinely open-minded about the individual, whoever they are.
That's right.
So your five strategies there, and I'll just repeat them because I check I got them right in terms of jotted them down. So I think it's always helpful when you're listening to it. I'm interested as to almost, do you build through them one by one, or do you at the start of the year go, actually this is one to focus in on, or some more important than others? And just the benefits for our audience. So we talked, the first one you said was sort of looking at the workplace culture. So have you got an inclusive culture? Of course, we're looking at this with the D&I hat on. Have you got a diverse workforce? So it's also looking about, are you benchmarking how inclusive you are, I guess, from your available workforce with context. Mm-hmm. Social responsibility, interesting that one. I don't fully understand how that links to diversity. Brand marketplace, is that about what you put out there? Maybe you can explain both those a bit more. And then I'm always interested in inclusive leadership, although I think that is one of the topics we probably come back to a lot. I think that is, of course, what drives culture as well in many ways, doesn't it? So do you want to just expand on it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the three that I'll expand on would be social responsibility and not necessarily, again, and we know it as CSR, right? And globally, you know, CSR is kind of the umbrella. Diversity falls under that. In the U.S., it's almost the other way around, where there's diversity as an umbrella and then the community aspect falls under diversity. And what I mean by community is not necessarily the charitable pieces. Charity does play a role, and I'll connect it to, but in even more or less the green initiatives. When I speak about social responsibility, is our commitment to the communities in which we live, work, and play. Where do we show up? Are we giving to underserved communities? Are we giving a chance for individuals who may have been incarcerated, our returning citizens? Are we giving them a chance to re-enter the workforce? You know, are we, there's skills everywhere. Are we looking at those who only have the ability to work from home? You know, so those are the things when it comes to the social responsibility aspect. When we are talking about gathering a workforce or building a talent pool that's best and brightest, we have to look beyond, you know, the general places that we have to look beyond, the job boards, and nothing against job boards at all, but we have to look beyond that. You know, there's organizations that are representative of communities that may be underrepresented. And it becomes one of the biggest, biggest things that prohibit us from having success in talent is that we're not looking beyond the usual areas of search. And so from a marketplace standpoint, just shifting to a marketplace, that really that fourth pillar, you know, that third being, first again, workplace culture, workforce, social responsibility, marketplace, is then taking all of the richness of the work that we do in D&I and promoting it back to client acquisition. Are we talking about the greatness of our workforce and our acknowledgments by community service? Are we talking about that in an RFP when we're out for that request for proposal? Are we talking about our alignment with the community and sustainability? So those are the things that we want to make sure. And then are we touting those awards on our website? Are we touting our community partnerships? Because when we are addressing or addressing a talent strategy and we are hiring from, you know, across the available workforce, and do we show that we've done something with pride in the LGBTQ community? You know, and that's where those pieces come back into the marketplace, where we then now express the great work that we do around D&I. Even those internal cultural celebrations, are we getting a chance for our clients to understand how we're celebrating culture internally? How are we recruiting? Where are we in our community? And so that marketplace piece is really huge for business advancement, as well as business growth and brand recognition. The last one that we talked about there, and I'll pause just to see if there's any questions on those two.
Pause, we'll come back to you in a second. I'm not sure it's contentious or not, but so the whole, I get that more in terms of social responsibility and the brand place. I suppose it occurs to me that some businesses would find it harder to actually recruit from in that area. So I'm seeing that maybe in some cases it's indirect. So it's almost what goes around comes around. So there's a bit there. Is that, would you see, you know, is, if you do it because the right thing to do, then hopefully that gets people back. And then ultimately, you know, you get a good brand name, or it's the right thing to do. People feel good because, you know, everyone gets a good sense of feeling. But I suppose there's a little bit there where I do think sometimes that it's seen as being tokenistic, that kind of stuff, this corporate social responsibility activities and things like that. So it's making it real and genuine, and maybe again, it's going to go back to leadership and culture. Just interested in your thoughts on that topic.
Yes, the question itself is refreshing to lead into that perspective, because there's sometimes a disconnect, which looks like tokenism. And the disconnect is usually when corporations have a foundation. That foundation is giving to a great organization like, you know, Go Red for Women or March of Dimes or Habitat for Humanity. But there's no employees on site building the house. Not that the gift alone doesn't represent value or care. The community, when that organization shows up and it has that company's logo on those shirts and it says that company cares, that message resonates far beyond a business or a marketing ploy. That shows that we really care. Those are employees with hammers, or they're on that food line for the homeless. You know, there's a great connection there to community and the business value, and that gives great business value. So it doesn't look like just a gift of a check, but when employees are engaged and involved, to giving back to homeless, to veterans, to disabilities, to uplifting children in education, even those organizations that just go out and read a book to an elementary school classroom.
Yes.
You know, that's value to the community. And that's what we want to express when we talk about how are we making an impact. It's not just about the value of the technology and the business and the strategy. It's also that, you know, now we're looking at millennials and Gen Zs. They are looking at our websites and saying, where have you given back? What are you doing in the community? Mm. You know, so the value of talent is connecting that story around the D&I strategy back out to the world, back out to the public. So yes, great point there. Great, great to mention that, because that's where that value connects beyond what we feel.
Mm-hmm. So So in terms of people looking at that, they look at the culture that's going on. They're looking at, you know, how we're doing it. These are ways in which you can. Those are two ways we just discussed a bit more in a deeper way, in which you can, you know, I suppose reinforce and just refresh or give life to your D&I strategy. As well as things, I guess, in terms of the workforce, would be things like talent and recruitment. You'd look at reasons if you did see there was a balance as to what was going on in terms of your, I mean, I guess actually that is something before we go into inclusive leadership. We went up back to the points one and two, the cultural, the workforce one. If you see you've got a discrepancy, what practical tactics would you put in place to address your strategic aims of being more balanced?
Yeah, most times, you know, a lot of organizations are looking at representation, you know, right? And, you know, we know the E comes into diversity, inclusion, the point around equity. And data is going to help us with that to understand where we're represented. But, you know, the piece that I always say that for our clients and internally for Workforce Logic is that we must have a methodology. We must set some markers. We must set some boundaries. And that's why it's also, you know, good to have those sound markers. Even if we're expressing, you know, internally, you know, we're a, you know, from promotions or hiring or opportunities to grow, you know, there are certain strategies that can be inserted in around mentoring, around sponsorship, inclusive mentoring and sponsorship, not calling out the underrepresented group, but ensuring that the underrepresented group is included in the mentoring initiative, not a mentoring program for the underrepresented group, because it, from an organizational effectiveness standpoint and a psychology standpoint, it creates almost a disingenuous low value for a group when you want to call them out. And this is why a lot of times—
like a quota thing. So people feel like they're just a quota then.
Yes. And that's why it's so important to make a richness of any initiatives that we have to infuse for balance or to push equity must be across the board, because there's so many assumptions that when there's underrepresentation, that the only uplift is for the underrepresented group, but that's not the case. Everyone in that organization should be uplifted and with some particular value, but we have to ensure that the upper underrepresented groups are a part of that strategic initiative to uplift the organization.
Are proportionately represented.
Yes.
Yes, isn't it? Because actually, you don't want to positively discriminate against the other people, you know, either. They've not done anything wrong. So therefore, you need to have markers all through your talent piece as to, are you recruiting in, do you have enough job applications in the first place? Do you have enough people interviewed? Do they get same levels of salary increase or promotion opportunities or whatever the things are that you look at in your organization, making sure you need to cut that data all through these kind of stepping points where people might get left out or leave. Mm-hmm.
And it's awesome that you bring that point up, because it is the true employee life cycle should have those metrics and data points and check-ins and checkpoints to ensure that there's equity in the process. And when there's not, there's adjustments. And that's where diversity inclusion comes in to help with those strategies. The D&I practitioner coming into the organization should be able to put a lens on even the HR, the CHRO strategy, and say, okay, well, here's where we have some deficiencies. Here's some, you know, strategic movement, some things that we can show value optimization and insert into that process. It's almost like the D&I person is more of a capacity builder to look at each area and find deficiencies, but find ways that we can actually invigorate either innovation through our people or putting in strategies that are going to give some uplift and some, again, some value optimization.
It's almost like a mirror or a safety valve as well, isn't it? It's just to kind of build that awareness of things that maybe get this whole unconscious piece is having that taking a step back and actually looking at what's really going on and reflecting it back into the organization they wouldn't necessarily be aware of.
Absolutely. And that adjustment is simply ensuring that there's business integration with the D&I strategy, because all of those pieces you mentioned around making sure that, you know, there's check-ins, data points along the way is about ensuring that the business strategy is being achieved.
Right. Okay. So that's I think that's really key and useful there. So then your piece on inclusive leadership that you say lots of people don't do as much about. So what do you recommend doing there, and why don't you think that gets covered?
Yes, that fifth piece of the pillar of kind of just an overlaying from the D&I strategy, I think is very important. It's one that cannot be missed, because a lot of D&I executives may believe the four key strategies, which is almost, you know, consistent across workforce, workplace, marketplace, and then social responsibility as well. But that doesn't necessarily dictate or expresses the behaviors that it's going to take to achieve the strategy. And so a lot of times that's left out. And so when we look at inclusive leadership, we're looking at how do we show up to work. From an HR leadership standpoint, you think about all the leadership traits, you know, time management and, you know, leadership and flexibility and all of the things that we put in the leadership criteria and performance ratings, right? These are the things that we rate people on to move to the next level. Well, a D&I lens on those performance indicators is like a little bubble that pops up. It's like, what does flexibility mean from a D&I with a D&I lens, right? Are we talking about being flexible and understanding that, you know, we need to integrate someone with a disability in the workforce and how we're doing it? Are we being flexible and understanding that, you know, from a gender balance or a parenting balance, no matter who's parenting or no matter who's caring for an elderly parent, that we're giving them flexibility? Mm. Like, what is the lens on the term leadership? You know, are we encouraging? Are our communication skills, are we moving across the communication spectrum, right? Are we talking to our employees who are direct communicators in a direct voice? And are we switching our communication style to say good morning and hi, how are you doing, Lucinda, to those employees who are indirect? So the expression of leadership skills through a diversity lens gives us the behaviors associated with that. And so those who are working in organizational effectiveness, and really bringing about, you know, that I'll always say the lens from the psychological perspective, we have to bring those leadership skills to life. And that's what inclusive leadership does for an organization. It's like really saying, you know, when we talk about team engagement, you know, or motivation, you know, all of those leadership terms that show up, you're going to get a rating on, you know, are you saying hello? Yeah. Or are you walking down one side of the office and only saying hello to those on one side of the office? Are you saying hello to everyone? How do you do that? And so those simple things, and are you saying hello and thank you when the task is done? Those are the things that we have to bring to life around inclusive leadership. And then there's also allyship and altruism that plays a role in that as well. And we have to understand how those things come into the organization and interact with our employees as well.
So again, it's, I guess you would have said these same 5 points, I'm assuming, 2 years ago before COVID came about. But the impact of COVID, what you're saying to me here is a lot of what I'd say is really important in being an effective people manager in hybrid environment. It's been about being people centric first. So it's, and it's flipping the organization, you know, whereas, you know, 3 years ago, it was all about, well, this is the organization, you come to this building, you work these hours. And if you can't do that, then actually we can't accommodate you. Whereas it's a bit of it on its head now that we should go, right, what do you need? How can we align your needs with the organization's needs? Mm-hmm. And also you map on diversity, you know, well, again, it's really just about treating the person as an individual and being inclusive again, isn't it? But you would have been saying this all along, I assume. It's just that maybe it almost seems more achievable, does it? In that these things, the paradigms have shifted about what's possible.
Yes, and it goes back to that where our journey, right, has come from in, as human resources practitioners, that personnel management to human capital strategies to total inclusion. Like, we have to have a total lens on the individual that's coming to work and how we need to help them be the best, you know, employee that they can be. You know, not only them bringing, you know, a lot of times we hear the term, well, we want our employees to bring their whole self to work. Well, I'm here to inform everyone that that person brings their whole self to work every day. We have to figure out how do we get the most out of that person based on what they're bringing. And we've never taken the time to understand when someone comes to work with stress in their community.
Yeah.
Are we able to address that stress? And again, that was the big determining factor last year with the George Floyd incident in the States, where people and a lot of individuals wrote articles about this, you know, crying faces offline, smiling faces once the Zoom is on or once the call starts.
Right.
Like, you know, how are we interacting? How are we helping our employees cope with societal issues? And are we understanding those as a business, you know, and as an employer? Because a lot of people were wiping tears and getting on calls, and we expected it to be business as usual. without taking a pause. And I love many of the organizations around the world that will take a pause to acknowledge the individual's pain because they're trying to work through that pain. And so this total inclusive lens driving the business strategy is very important at this stage. And I think it's only going to become more important as we move forward. I think the days of not looking at the individual are certainly gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is, again, this uplift around just simple things in same-sex benefits in countries that that adopt the pride notion. You know, those are the things that make that person truly their whole self at work. And we have to make an assessment of, if we are asking someone to bring their whole self to work, are we blocking any aspect of that person? And I think that's the piece that we have to ensure that we're not doing.
And ultimately, that's where you do have to have the inclusive leadership, because you can't do that as a, those first four points, you could do that as a D&I professional, as an HR professional,
yes,
as an organization. But fundamentally, to touch the individual, it all comes down to us reaching out for our, it's through our line managers again. It's like line managers drive engagement, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
Right, we've probably got another 5 minutes, haven't we? I've just got one question, because we mentioned it earlier. You mentioned the great resignation is out there. So you've mentioned it, so it sounds like it's real. So some people are saying, so I have two questions to you. One, would you say it's real? And the second one, is there a diversity factor or impact? What are you seeing in this?
Yeah, and that's an awesome point. There's two things. There is a diversity factor, because it assesses total inclusion. And that is the piece that I'm, again, in this evolution, this is just where we are now. We're at a point where all voices must be heard and all points of the dimensions of diversity must be considered. And as it relates to, is it real? It's real when the business doesn't adhere to how I need to work or how I need to come to work.
So if they go back to being paternalistic, then you will get it. Whereas if you try to be flexible, then you may not be having such a problem.
That's right. That's right. So we as employers are creating the great resignation.
Right.
Because after the pandemic has shifted the mind. We're not dealing with the same mental elements of the employee that were before the pandemic. And we cannot come back and try to address the individual the way we did before the pandemic. Time with family, time with kids, time to fish, time to meditate. We can't go backwards.
I think that's the thing I saw someone the other day. You know, when you think about how much, I mean, over here, I'm sure it's the same in the States, but how many people spend 4 hours a day commuting into London and sitting on, part of which is sitting on a tube train, which would be an incubator for let alone COVID or any virus, right? Like, you know, I wonder if everyone was full of colds and everything. You can see why people go, actually, I don't want to do that every single day. And I've demonstrated that I've been effective. That's not to say you don't want to go in some of the time, but you can see why people go, if you're going to force me back 5 days a week, then it doesn't really make sense. So your sense of it is, it's not, you're not necessarily seeing a sort of a gender or a racial link. It's more about people's individual wants and circumstances where it's coming through.
Absolutely. It's not a point where, I've had this time off and I don't want to work. That is not the case.
No.
And it's not, and no one's bringing, which is a great, thank you for bringing that point up, because no one's bringing, because I am this gender or this ethnicity or this race, I really don't want to go back into office. It's really about the value of life.
Yes, quality of life.
It's quality of life. And, you know, we were thrust into work-life balance. This was true work-life balance. When you work at home, this is trying to figure out, okay, what do I do to kids? The kids are home. My cat's on the table. My dog's running across and, you know, barking behind me. This is work. This is the true value of what we've all been talking about, this work-life integration, because, you know, work-life balance or that, you know, particular concept. This was the first time this ever happened for us in this way in this day and age. And we've figured out that we can make it work and still be productive.
So, William, we're at the point where we've only got 5 minutes left, but I would love to go into, we talked off camera, didn't we, about the sort of 5 levels of awareness for your executives. If you, how do you make diversity and inclusion live as opposed to be lip service? And you described these 5 levels for me, and I felt it was really useful if we could get this into the podcast. Would you like to just explain that for me, please?
Sure, Lucinda, absolutely. It's always good to, you know, find a topic and really express and expand on it. And one of the things I think is, you know, we have a definitive marker of giving to the organization as D&I executives or chief diversity officers. But we must first overcome a hurdle. And that hurdle is the understanding of diversity inclusion and how it impacts the organization from an executive standpoint. So there's really 5 levels, I think, of understanding that executives must have in order to really truly understand the impact of diversity inclusion and then embrace that impact and infuse it into business strategy. So how do we get there? There's 5 levels of learning or understanding. Those first 2 levels, I think everybody gets. And not only the executive, everybody gets these first 2 levels. They understand, you know, diversity comes from this compliance, or it was birthed from compliance, right? Mm. And so they understand the legalities of diversity. But then levels 2 is they also understanding talent and culture. Like, you know, we must recruit from all talent pools, and then we must celebrate those cultures. But unfortunately, it's like an elevator, and that's where the elevator of understanding stops. As chief diversity officers, as HR leaders, CHROs around the world, we must move them beyond that understanding, that limited capacity of understanding, move them into levels 3, 4, and 5, which is economic value at 3, innovation at 4, and that 5th is business integration. And where does diversity integrate with the business strategy, which from that D&I lens? And those are simply the 5 pillars that we talked about earlier. The key points here around economic value is that everything that diversity inclusion touches in the organization has a financial formula. That is so missed. Even when we were talking about culture and when we're talking about talent, and we HR executives, we know there's a scorecard, right? Well, that diversity also infuses more value into the scorecard around time to recruit. Are we accessing all talent? The, you know, pieces that I think are awesome around culture that we miss is that, you know, from a culture standpoint, really leading into innovation. Are we making it possible for all employees to participate in the value and the effort of diversity and inclusion? And, you know, my advice has always been, and that several of my colleagues as well, has always been around setting the tone that everyone gets to participate. But there's a lot of organizations that will launch resource groups first before launching a full inclusion council. And so it actually then becomes limited because the ability for individuals to participate sometimes only center around the ERGs or employee resource groups that are then set up. And so it actually limits the participation. You know, the advice is really to expand that participation, create a workforce group. You know, we have innovation teams at Workforce Logic, but those innovation teams also represent the 5 key pillars. We have an innovation team for workforce and culture. We have an innovation group for task force for workforce and acquiring talent, as well as social responsibility and marketplace. Again, how do we tell our stories? This is coming from all employees of all perspectives. So this is coming from women. This is coming from men. This is coming from those from the LGBTQ veterans, Asian, Hispanic, all of the predominant groups that we usually launch for resource groups. They're working together. And so when we're talking about culture and culture value, they're actually working together to achieve those goals.
So let me just reflect back to check I'm understanding. So I get your levels 1 and 2 are kind of the basics, which where lots of organizations are basically playing lip service. So they're kind of doing it because it's the right thing to do in terms of compliance. And they might look at it and understand it in terms of talent and culture. The next piece is your economic piece, which I can see, I know you're only ever going to get the HR, the FD into this, if you actually know that the economics of it are going to work. And I think that's a good way to get people bought into it, isn't it? So I know you just jumped out there. I was just going through the top 3, William, and I was just going to the economics piece. So I was just, we've got lip service with compliance and talent and culture, and then we've got the economic value piece. when I first heard you say about the innovation, I was thinking if you've got more diverse people, then you're going to be more innovative, which is true, but you're not talking about it in that context. You're saying rather than, and actually this is, I thought about asking you this question earlier, rather than kind of going have a women's group and a LGBT group, you're saying have diverse groups. Do you want to expect, well, I'm going to say, are you against, you know, the, would you say don't do the women in tech group, or what's your position on those? Because it sounds like, I wasn't certain that you'd think that was the right thing to do.
Sure. I think when you, I would say launch a D&I initiative with all engage. At that point, you can absolutely build communities around culture and build communities. You know, a lot of times individuals want safe space conversations. But when you launch diversity inclusion and launch your people engagement, it's most important that it happens in an inclusive environment. When it's done the other way around, or you know, the gender and ethnicity and race groups are formed first, it again creates that understanding that diversity may not include me. And a lot of times when we launch organizational councils, the innovation piece is so important because you want everybody at the table. And so you want groups working together on culture initiatives and not in what I would call an echo chamber, because we lose so much context of information and understanding when groups are working alone in siloed race groups or gender groups to bring in a speaker. You know, you can imagine the number of phenomenal women that are discussed in a women in tech group in an organization, within an organization employee resource group that no one else hears, but they only hear about the one group that came in. So for our formula in bringing a workplace culture innovation team together, we get to talk about what we're doing in celebration of Women History Month or International Women's Day or Hispanic Heritage Month or Disability Awareness. The richness of that conversation with everyone engaged and involved, we are celebrating our similarities and learning from our differences. We don't get to do that in silo groups. And I think that's the piece that makes it a little limiting.
Yeah. And you know, it's really interesting because I've always slightly felt uncomfortable about siloed groups, because obviously you can't have women in tech, and I get why they're out there, and stuff, but I've always felt a bit uncomfortable. And I think that point is that it's not making it, well, some of the problems, I suppose, of being a minority is a them and us. And if you then have a siloed group, then it just almost reinforces that them and us. Whereas if you have an overall inclusivity group, so that's different. So it's not like you're saying we want to have men, I'm going male, females, it's just less content, easier. We want men on our women in tech group. It's not as simple as that. What you're saying is more, let's think holistically about inclusivity.
And that's a great point. And I am going to really draw a very small box here, that my perspective around this is inside the organization.
Yes.
Professional associations that I love and support. I love the fact that there's focused professional association, because it makes a better employee inside the organization, because they draw strength from that. But internal into the organization, we really need to look at drawing that innovation across all employees of all walks of life and bringing them together to understand that diversity simply means everyone.
Yes, and being
it
inclusive.
It reinforces an old paradigm, unfortunately, and predominantly for cisgender white males, when there's no resource group for cisgender white males.
Yeah.
But there's a diversity and inclusion council for everybody.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
including cisgender white males.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's everyone. And it's, I challenged, you know, I've been challenged to create a holistic environment that includes everyone. And so when we launched the council at Workforce Logic, you know, we made a call for champions, and everyone showed up of every walk of life, with disabilities, neurodiversities, women, Asian, Hispanic, you know, African heritage, you know, Asian. It just, everyone showed up and everyone participates. And where they participate in that strategy, again, linking back to the business strategy and those five key pillars I chose earlier, they don't necessarily participate as allies first. They participate through altruism first. And so our employees get to pick where they want to contribute their time, whether it's going to be celebrating cultures, improving our workforce, improving our community value and charity and where we show up in green initiatives. And then those employees who want to make sure we're best in brand and best in class, they participate in those areas. And we do all the cultural celebrations and we plan them as a collective and thereby learning in that process as well and understanding cultural nuances and do's and don'ts and gives us a chance to really learn from a collective standpoint. So again, going back to that comment around we're at a point of total inclusion in the organizations we're talking about total inclusion, you know, the advice is really to begin to launch with an inclusion council, get everyone engaged and involved in this initiative. And then communities can spawn out of that, which will have specific gender or other related communities. You know, a lot of times we talk about safe space conversations for communities. But remember that even safe space conversations includes a diverse audience for those who care and have empathy for a particular cause or advancement. And so that's just a perspective on those levels of learning.
I think that's really helpful. Critical. No, I really do, that total inclusivity goes back to our point, you know, diversity is a philosophy. And that kind of, it's a really good one to say, rather than go down narrow groups, your diversity council is doing something that's inclusive in the first place. And then, of course, that's naturally going to lead to business integration. It's going to weave things in. It's going to uncover biases and solve things much more because everybody's part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's across the organization, both vertically and horizontally. You know, we have business unit leaders, presidents, who participate on the council. It doesn't negate anyone. There's no levels of hierarchy on the council. There's no leadership council within an employee council. It is the council. Yeah. So when we talk diversity and inclusion, it resonates organization-wide across APAC, EMEA, and the Americas, and across all leaders at all levels, which, again, as you said earlier, that's what makes an innovative team. That's what spawns innovation, mm-hmm. when the conversations are happening at all levels in real time.
And it feeds back down the line as well, I guess. So that's then you'll get economic benefit, you'll affect the culture positively, and obviously you'll be compliant. I guess we're going to have to leave it there, William. I know I keep on asking you questions that I want to share with the audience, but thank you so much for You're expanding welcome. On that. I thought that was a really useful area to explore. So thanks again. And I guess in terms of our listeners, if they want to get in touch with you, can they reach out to you on LinkedIn?
They absolutely can. Absolutely.
So it's William T. Rolak, isn't it? Is the best way to find you on LinkedIn. And we'll put the link in the show notes. So thanks again for joining us today. It's been fantastic talking to you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it and really educational as well and practical. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Lucinda. This has been wonderful.
I really hope you found this week's episode useful and enjoyable. If you did, perhaps you could recommend us to a friend or colleague or give us a review on your platform of choice. It really helps new listeners to find us. Now, you can access links to any of the information mentioned in this show via the website www.hruprising.com. Further free resources are also available at www.actus.co.uk. There you can also find out more about our software and training solutions. Finally, why not join our LinkedIn group, The HR Uprising, to share ideas and collaborate with other like-minded people professionals. Thank you for listening to the HR Uprising podcast.